Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 447. This is a very special episode for the Sister Wives and I. We will get to that in a minute. But I would like to say that Matt Meyer and I are going to be doing some stand-up on the road. Well, on the road. It's not really on the road to you guys, it's just on the road to us. With you guys, it's your hometowns. Minneapolis on Friday, December 6th, and Chicago on Saturday, December 7th, and Seattle on Friday, the 13th of December. Go to Nerdist.com/calendar to get info on that. We're at Mill City Nights in Minneapolis, Vic Theater in Chicago, and Showbox in Seattle. So there you go. There's that. This episode was brought to you by NatureBox. We'd like to welcome our new sponsor, NatureBox. They will deliver healthy snacks right to your door and essentially into your mouth, into your waiting mouth. They could technically deliver delicious, healthy snacks. It's a subscription service, and it offers you the ability to discover, enjoy healthy snacks on a monthly basis. All of us right now on the podcast are in a fitness training program. We're not afraid. We're not afraid of you, fitness. And one of the things that's helpful is if you have kind of healthy snacks to eat throughout the day, so you don't gorge yourself in one giant meal. And NatureBox is a perfect solution for something like this. They offer wholesome ingredients. It's nutritionist approved, so there's no high fructose corn syrup, there's no partially hydrogenated oils, no trans fat, no artificial sweeteners, no artificial flavors, no artificial colors. They're just delicious, healthy snacks. Each bag is full-size, 3 to 5 servings of snack in it, and they offer 3 different price programs. So, you can get the Deluxe Snacker, which is 5 bags for $19.95, the Happy Snacker, which is 10 bags for $29.95, or a Smart Snacker, which is 20 bags for $49.95. The monthly box always ships for free, with the exception of Hawaii or Alaska. Sorry! If you use the coupon code Nerdist, you're going to get 50% off your first box at naturebox.com, and you're going to support this show. So again, highly, highly, highly recommend delicious, healthy snacks delivered right to your mouth or your door. Technically, your mouth is your body's door. We welcome them to the Nerdist Podcast. And now we welcome you to this particular episode, which is Christopher Lloyd. This is one of those ones when we first started the podcast, was always sort of on our bucket list of like, wait, someday we... It'd be really awesome if we had Christopher Lloyd. And we got him on the show. And, of course, we all very much had to temper the fanboyish stuff. But I feel like we did, a good job. I think we did okay. And he was awesome. And he talked about everything. We got Back to the Future stories. We got Adam's Family stories. We got Taxi stories. He talked about Andy Kaufman. And he was, all in all, just a super sweet guy. I hope you enjoy this as much as we enjoyed doing it. I would like to tell you that Christopher Lloyd has a new show on PBS right now called Cyber Chase. He's the voice of the hacker. And check that out. It's a math-based show. It's a math-based kids animated program. But this is a real-based kids and adult kids program. The Nerdist Podcast number 447 with Christopher Lloyd! I am so excited I get to say those words.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Having a Mel Blanc conversation right now.
Uh-huh.
Did you ever work with Mel Blanc?
No.
Did you know him?
No.
Oh, then this isn't going to go very well.
Enjoy his voiceovers, right?
Yeah.
So many cartoons.
Yeah.
Warner Brothers
cartoons.
Yeah, all the Warner Brothers stuff, and yeah. he essentially just revolutionized that whole industry. But we are here to talk about you. We've already started.
Well,
is that okay?
I never talk about myself.
Ever? Do you not like to talk about yourself?
I'm not that kind of guy.
What do you want to talk about?
Me?
He doesn't talk about himself, only him.
maybe we could do the thing where we pressure you and you're like, I don't want to. Okay.
No.
Okay. Oh, here's your cappuccino. We'll get your cappuccino here and then we'll start.
Yeah.
Did they have caramel?
Yes.
Wow. Incredible.
It's a good little cafe down there.
I wanted one so much, I didn't. Yeah, I figured that's. No way.
That'll loosen your tongue.
Me juice.
Good. How is it?
Good.
Okay,
it's
good.
It's good.
Good. Well, welcome. It's nice to see you. We are super Thank honored you. To have you on the show.
All right.
I know we're going to talk about CyberChase. Uh-huh. We're going to talk about CyberChase on PBS, which is a show you do. But, you know, there's a lot of things that, you know.
Have come up.
That are going to come up in the process that I'm sure always do. I mean, there's so many different things. I mean, we could devote an episode to each project and just talk about that if you are willing to. But so this is the beginning of the 12-part Christopher Lloyd series. You're going to come back every day for 12 days, right?
Okay.
No, we should all do it all at once.
We're at day 3 of the Christopher Lloyd. Our voices are gone.
We haven't let him go. We had to tape him to the chair, but I think he's finally loosening up a little bit. I think I saw you at a Wizard World or something, a convention. You were doing signings at a convention a couple of years ago.
Oh, probably.
Yeah. Do you do a lot of the convention circuit?
I do some of them, yeah.
Yeah.
I do 2-3 a year. They're just signing.
Yeah.
Comp cons or something.
Yeah, yeah. Are you used to... You must be used to, after all these decades of people freaking out when they come face to face.
Some do. Some do. You know, happens.
Yeah.
It's just a kind of a shock because people have seen people on the, you know, they like to look out on the screen without any real expectation they're ever going to meet them or that they actually exist. You know, and then suddenly they're there, and they're like, kind of blown away.
Did you ever have that about anyone?
Yeah, more than once. I can only think of two instances at the moment. I was sitting on a stoop in New York, that went down a couple of steps, 2 or 3 steps, into a Japanese restaurant, and it was sunny, and I was like 54th Street or something. I was sitting there, and then I was like 2 or 3 people came over, and I was aware there was like a huge shadow coming from one person. I looked up, and it was Orson Welles.
Whoa.
Fuck. I just couldn't believe it. And they went into the restaurant, and I couldn't resist. I went in and sat at the sushi bar. They were down there just to stare. You know, just Orson Welles. I mean, he like shook the world. You know? So,
what stage of your career were you at that point? Would he have recognized you?
No. I was. I haven't done anything on a film. I was just in New York, you know, doing theater.
Did you talk to him?
No.
What year was this?
It was in the '60s.
Yeah.
Around mid-60s, later 60s.
I mean, we all have that human experience, and it's sort of like what you said. You see someone on a big screen, and you get this expectation. And honestly, no matter how much you try to compose yourself or how much you think, I'm going to say the perfect thing, it just never, like all the words just bottleneck as they come out of your mouth.
Right.
When you started, you did a lot of theater in New York first.
Mm-hmm.
And then Cuckoo's Nest, was that the first
yeah.
movie? Yeah. Did they see you in a play or did you audition or?
No. I just had gotten nowhere with film. I wanted to do film. I didn't want to come to LA without having some film, you know, because I'd just be another face. But I did want to do film, but and I went up for a lot of films and absolutely nothing, you know, no response, no callbacks, you know, and all that. So I figured, you know, some actors don't make the transition somehow from the stage to screen. So I figured I may be one of those. And then they came to town, Saul's aunts, Michael Douglas and Milos Forman, to see people in New York. And over the years, was familiar with a casting director in New York. And he just had a hunch and he sent me up. And that was that.
I mean, DeVito was in that too.
DeVito was in that, yep.
Did you guys know each other before?
No.
So the taxi thing was a complete coincidence.
Cuckoo's Nest was before Taxi.
Right. But the fact that you both ended up on that show was a complete...
Yeah, we were both in Cuckoo's Nest. And I don't know if Danny had anything to do with getting into Taxi. I've never asked him. I have no idea. But we both, there we were. And Vincent Schiavelli.
Oh, Vincent Schiavelli, too.
He was also Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
And then in Taxi.
Was when you got Cuckoo's Nest, did you have representation from being a theater actor, or did you just have the personal relationships with the casting director?
I didn't have representation in New York until almost before I left, and it was very sketchy. It was then, you know, I just couldn't seem to pick up an agent.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of workshops off Broadway continually. Sometimes I was doing two or three at a time. And for every one, I'd send out pictures, updated resume to every agent listed. I had the thing with all that. Nothing. Huh. Absolutely nothing. And then, but I started getting work in theater, so. No, I really wasn't signed. When I came out to L.A., which kind of triggered, I got a letter from an agent here. Well, after Cuckoo's Nest came out, because I went back to New York after we shot Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
Say that if I ever came to town here, he'd like to see me, have lunch. He didn't make an offer or anything like that.
It was casual.
So that was 1976. So I came out, we had lunch, and I've been signed with him ever since.
Oh, no, same guy.
It's been good lunch.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when Taxi started, you were essentially a guest star. Jim Gutowski was just a guest star.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm old enough to have watched. I watched Taxi in first run. And, it was, I think it was pretty clear right away, like, oh, shit, who's that guy? And then season two, you were regular on the show. Was it really just going to be, like, an episode?
As far as I know, I don't know what they may have had behind, but that's all I expected. And then after... we shot it. It seemed like something was in the air.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Did you see that? Did you see sitcoms as essentially an extension of theater at that point?
I didn't want to do a sitcom.
Really?
I did not want to do a sitcom. I had a bit of an attitude, I have to admit. You know, being a New York theater actor.
Yeah.
And in that time, I don't know how, I don't think it matters anymore, but back then, if you were a theater actor and you went to Hollywood, you were fucking selling your soul. I mean, when I first came out here, there was an actor, a friend of mine, who hated Hollywood, anything California. He was like a total New York person and theater. But he'd come out here for 6 months to make enough money to do theater work back in New York for the rest of the year, and he hated it. And he'd get into hot arguments and nearly fist fights because he'd attack and because I would go out with him and we'd go to parties with New York people who are out here, New York people, and if he heard somebody start praising L.A.,
that was it.
And he was very, very bright, educated, and articulate, and vehement. He just like lit into him, you know. And it would get hot, this dichotomy of New Yorkers, you know. So I didn't, I wasn't about to. And that was the ultimate sellout. Sitcoms.
Yeah. Well, that's what's so funny is I feel like there is a little bit of it, and I think it's cooled off some, but yeah. I still sense this rivalry between New York and L.A., which I think is more on the New York side than the L.A. side.
Probably.
And you hear people...
L.A. never had a soul in the first place.
They didn't have a soul. So they don't...
Sorry.
my theory about it is that I feel like a lot of cities have rivals with L.A., and L.A. is sort of like that clueless valley girl that does, it's just thinking about itself, so it has no idea that there are rivalries with other people. Because it's looking in the mirror and going, no, am I fat? You know, like that's all.
Yeah, we're too preoccupied enjoying the weather.
That's true. It's kind of nice. But what I find is that, you know, the same people that do shit on L.A. are always like, yeah, but I'm going to go out there for pilot season. You're like,
you
know, you're still coming out here.
Right.
You can't hate it that much, you know.
Well, they probably hate it because they feel they have to be out here. To, like your friend, like, he probably resented it to do what he wanted to do. He had to come out here to make money.
Yeah.
And that probably just added to just like, it's like, I have to be here. Ugh, the worst.
Well, you also have to keep in mind that in the 70s, too, it was really, that was sort of the television revolution of really kind of more realistic, grounded shows like the Norman Lear and James Brooks, like all those shows, those didn't exist before that. So sitcoms were very much like, everything's a perfect silly world, you know?
Yeah.
So it really wasn't until like, you know, the All in the Families and the Taxis of the world that sitcoms actually became like a real art form.
That's right.
So when you, and Taxi, by the way, I think of Taxi as running as long as Cheers, but it was only on for like five seasons.
Five seasons.
And two different networks, right?
And two different networks, yeah.
It was dropped from the first network. I forget.
I think it was ABC and then it went to NBC.
Yeah. It was dropped from ABC. And one thing, that they hadn't done 100 shows yet, so they weren't eligible for
syndication.
So that HBO offered to do 12 one-hour shows with no censorship, something like that, and it had to be unanimous consent from the cast and all. And I don't know if it ever came up to a vote, but then NBC stepped in.
Oh, wow.
That would have been...
And picked it up.
It's kind of weird to hear HBO doing that back in the 70s, which is effectively what they ended up doing. That's what they do now.
Yeah.
But that was incredible, though. Like, I imagine it would have got a lot darker.
Maybe, but I don't know.
Yeah, it could have been fun. You know, it was intriguing.
I don't know if America would have been ready for that yet.
Do you think they still would have kept it? Would they have still kept it in the multicam format, do you think?
I think that was the idea.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Just, wow.
We were all, when NBC picked it up, that's the right network, right?
NBC. Mm-hmm, yeah.
We were all invited, all the Saturday night show, the whole cast. And in the show, they had a set that somehow was like a projection of CBS that had Taxi initially?
Yeah. Oh, was it CBS? I said ABC. It might have been CBS.
Or ABC.
Yeah.
Or may say ABC. They had a projection up on a, like a screen of the ABC building on 6th Avenue. And then they had a little, one of those boxes, the thing that you plunge. and Danny DeVito came on stage and the projection fell apart. kind of fun.
Was it a fun show to do? Do you think of it fondly? Or was
Taxi?
It, yeah.
I thought it was amazing. I mean, the cast was amazing. Great writers. The whole spirit of the thing was Brooks and Ed Weinberger. I mean, it was great.
Sam Simon.
I was so amazed when I was and who?
Sam Simon.
Sam Simon. Yeah. And watching rehearsals initially, I thought, fuck, you know, in New York they're talking about ensembles and how to create an ensemble, and an ensemble was the peak of the art form. These guys were doing it, you know, Judd Hirsch and Danny and Tony Danza, Mary Lou, Jesus.
Andy Kaufman was
Andy Kaufman and Bob, unfortunately, passed away not too long ago.
Oh, Jeff Conaway.
Jeff Conaway, and there was just a great group.
Yeah. Did you sense at the time that did you start to warm up to television a little bit after a season or two and go, it's not so bad? It's
yeah,
not so bad.
You know, definitely. I mean, a lot of them were New York people. I have a terrible time with names, which are embarrassing. The director.
Oh, James Brooks?
James Brooks. I mean, he's had a New York theater background with his dad. And Danny was from New York. So he was from New York.
It really was theater. I mean, like, it was essentially, you guys almost never left.
Yeah.
You never left that taxi stand. I mean, you almost never left that garage.
Yeah.
Occasionally. Except for the one episode where we got your backstory, and I think Ignatowski was at Harvard, and his girlfriend convinced him to have like one pot brownie, and then your transformation from that to the Reverend Jim face, like in a second, was fucking amazing. Where did that guy? Where did he come from? Where did Jim come from?
I don't know. I just sort of when I was going up to meet the guys. I had a friend who lived in Laurel Canyon who was cleaning out the bushes around his house and found that jacket with a peace sign, faded beat up jacket. I had faded beat up jeans, an ex-father-in-law's sneakers, which were all worn out. I just put it all on. But it was funny because we'd have hiatuses or breaks, and sometimes I'd come back and I couldn't get Jim Ignatowski back.
Really?
You know, I'd be like kind of finding it, you know?
Yeah.
And I guess I'd always get there eventually. But I realized that the thing that popped me back into it was thinking about my older brother. I had a brother who was 22 years than I. He's passed away. But he never smoked, drank, nothing, straight. But he had always a look on his face, kind of. everything would click in.
Did he know? Did he ever know?
I sent him somebody drew a thing of a portrait of Reverend Jim, and I sent it to him, and I thanked him. But I never got a thank you.
Oh, so I look like that, do I? So then, you know, very few people at that time, because television was very much a different world from film, and television stars very rarely ever made the jump to film. And you were able to do that.
Yeah, things might have, because I had Cuckoo's Nest, and it was a very successful film before I had Taxi, so I think that helped. You know, I had that as validation that I could do film work. I don't know. I was kind of surprised about the amount of film work I was getting, and sometimes I was bewildered about what they saw in me that they asked me to do the parts I did. You know, I was just like, still puzzles me a little bit.
Well, I think I think, you know, if you're the main lead on a show and you're like the lead guy, I think film kind of goes, oh, well, do we just make, I don't think they have an imagination in terms of what to do with that, but Jim was such a strong character that I think it's sort of, I think they pretty much, they realized pretty quickly that they could put you into something and you could disappear into, I mean, like seeing you in Star Trek III and then at first going, that looks familiar, and then hearing your voice and going, I think that's Christopher Lloyd. Like, how did you?
I never understood how that, because that was like offered outright. I didn't audition for it, I don't think. I thought, where did this come from? Where? What do they see that I don't know about, or something? You know, I guess I need to know myself better. Maybe I get more work. But yeah, that happened a few times.
As you continued on, like after Taxi, did you find that as people who, you know, loved
Taxi grew up and into positions where they were making stuff or making the decisions to cast stuff. Like, did you find that fans of yours were starting to hire you for stuff?
No. No, not that. Well, in a certain sense, maybe eventually, but I think at the time, they weren't. Maybe they were fans. I didn't know it, but they weren't people I knew.
Yeah.
Personally, they just sort of came up.
The whole Star Trek thing is kind of funny to me because essentially you had pretty much no interaction with anyone else because you were just basically on the you were on the bridge of the Klingon war the entire movie pretty
right.
much. So they really probably, I assume they just kind of shot you off by yourself and then shot the rest of the movie with Shatner and everyone else.
Yeah, I wasn't in, except the fight with Shatner at the end, and that was about it.
Were you a Star Trek fan before then?
No. I wasn't anti-Star Trek, but I just had never gotten into it.
Yeah. Are you, what's your kind of work ethic? I mean, do you go out looking for stuff, or
I don't know. I pretty much depended on the kindness of strangers, so to speak, you know, for people to call up. I when I was in New York, I don't know. I've never walked into an office and had the feeling that the people sitting around there are impressed. You know, like I walk in, okay, they talk to me, whatever. And I walk out, and I've never felt that electrified the place.
But that's how I feel like that's how the audition process is. I feel like when you feel, oh, I think I killed it. Then you leave, and they're like, "Oh, we're going in another direction."
Auditions sometimes, I would know whether it really worked or not. I may not have been what they were looking for, but I nailed it on my own terms. But it wasn't exactly what they were looking for. And that's a good feeling, you know, whether you get it or not. It's nice to know that you hit a home run. Yeah.
Like you had the ability to.
Yeah.
Right for
yeah.
It.
So that was good feeling. But I didn't really get into that until I came out here from New York.
Did you audition for Back to the Future, or did Zemeckis offer it to you?
I think it was kind of an offer. Yeah. I told the story a few times, and I'm kind of embarrassed every time I tell it. But well, I was doing a film in Mexico, like in Mexico City or various areas, and Bob Gersh, my agent, of some time, he sent me the script for Back to the Future to take a look at and read it, and then come back and meet Bob Zemeckis. I didn't know anything about Bob Zemeckis. Never heard of him. And at the same time, I got an offer to go to back east to do a play about Hans Christian Andersen. I was going to be Hans Christian Andersen, and Colleen Dewhurst,
Ringwell,
was going to be my mother at the Long Wharf Theater in New Haven, Connecticut. And I was skeptical about having come out to L.A., and I'm thinking, I thought about I got to go back to my roots. You know, I got to go back where essentially I belong, and I was beginning to work a lot in New York, working a lot in the theater, and I have feelings like I came out, because when I first came out here, Taxi didn't come up right away. I think I went for about 8 months, zilch, and everything, and I thought, fuck, you know. I got things rolling in New York. I come out here. I've lost momentum there. Nothing's happening here and all that. So I had some, you know, so this play came up, and I thought, that's what I got to do. That's what I got to do. And I got the script, and I had a girlfriend with me at the time, and I took the script, and I put it in the trash can. I just, like that. And she'd always heard me say it, because I was pretty zealous about getting work, that I never leave a stone unturned. If there was anything vaguely possible, in among the characters in a player's script, I'd go check it out. You know, I didn't care whether I lived on 107th Street and Riverside. I go all the way down to the Bowery for a rainy day, and stand in line and see what happens. And she said, "You always that's your mantra." And I thought, you know, she's right. So I picked it up. I looked at it. I went back, came back here. I sat down with Zemeckis, and that was it. I mean, I really, really liked him. I still do. He's wonderful. And I just felt okay. I saw it, and the play bombed.
So in an alternate universe, you're like, God damn it! Why did I take that play? Did you know? I mean, when you were because you guys had there were the Eric Stoltz months,
oh, yeah.
And then stopped, and then did it feel like, oh, this film's never going to get made, or it's too complicated, or people aren't going to get it?
No, I mean, Eric Stoltz, he's a wonderful actor, and I had no idea. I had no idea that was happening. We were 6 weeks shooting, and then one night, like one of them in the morning on a rainy night of the City of Industry, that parking lot there, and we have our 1 o'clock lunch or dinner, whatever you call it, and then we were told all to come to a certain area of the parking lot, and there was going to be a meeting, and they announced it. And Spielberg was there, and they announced it. And I had no idea. I had no premonition that it was going to happen. And it was very sad because he wasn't being fired because he was a bad actor or he didn't do it well. He was wonderful. But they wanted somebody with a kind of lightness, a comic flair, and they felt that they had to do that, that the film demanded it. So in came Michael, and I thought, fuck! You know, I spent 6 years, 6 weeks sweating it with every single take, wondering whether I was cutting it, you know, whether I was really, and I thought, I'll never be able to sum that up again. I was thinking, they didn't have to cut. They didn't have to. There was some stuff they could use, but it worked out fine. Wow. Yeah, and Michael's energy and personality, the chemistry was always. We always had from the get go great chemistry. I mean, it was not something that we had to work for, but it was very sad for him. Eric Stoltz.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen clips of that stuff, and he is playing it darker. He seems to be kind of more serious.
He was a little more serious.
Yeah, and it's such a weird, and you know, it's like Michael J. Fox is great at that, and it seems like you guys had that rapport as well, but yeah. It's just insane. That's the way it worked out.
Well, especially, you know, it's interesting because a movie like that and a character like Doc could potentially be a really, really big character. Like, how do you know? I mean, at the time you're shooting that, are you going, is this too much? Is this not enough? Or what is did it just kind of feel like it all made sense?
Yeah, I kind of felt where the energy was with him. So, you know, and he had his ups and downs, shit, you know. he had a very poignant moments in his relationship with Clara.
Yeah.
And those, he had a little despair there. And the blowing up the whole space-time continuum.
Yep.
Pretty serious.
Did you even know? So the first movie, I remember as a kid, I saw that movie, I don't know, 6 or 8 times in the theater. But it was really sort of back before you'd be like, oh, I'll wait till home video. I was like, I have to see this now as many times as possible.
Uh-huh.
And did they sign you on immediately for the trilogy, or did they do the first one? Because now they automatically sign people up for trilogies. Or did they come back, or did you kind of go, shit, this is a really big deal. Maybe we're going to do more of these.
I don't remember that anything specific was said. I mean, maybe Michael Liu or the powers that be had it all, you know, but I didn't, I don't think I remember hearing anything specific about a second one until some time later. I mean, when Back to the Future 1 opened, it was a great opening, you know. So that kind of assured there'd be a sequel. But it wasn't in the bag, as far as I knew, up until then. And then they going to do Back to the Future 2? And they started doing 2. I don't know what kind of games were going on. It was a pretty thick script. And then suddenly they're talking about, we're going to do 2 and 3 together. And we had about a 3-week, you had to do 2 and then 3. You couldn't, even if it was the same set, the same actors, you could not do a scene from 3. Like you do a scene from 2 and then do the scene from 3, that would, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was a union, some kind of union thing where that could not be done. So it was 2 and then 3 immediately after.
And they released them within a couple months of each other too. When they came out, it was this,
a couple of months for me.
They did, yeah. They did this kind of strange thing that
had the preview for it at the end of
two, yeah. And then yeah, it was like November. They ran 2, and then like in the spring they released 3 because they shot them. I guess they got shot everything at once.
Yeah.
So they released them essentially back to back.
Huh.
I'm maybe hoping that, you know, like, oh, this will just, people just wait a couple months and then go saying, I guess it probably worked. Did you notice any difference between Doc from 1, 2, and 3? Did there, was it pretty much the same guy to
I
you?
Thought it was, you know, the same guy. I felt like the same kind of urgency in all of them. Everything was always urgent.
Yeah.
Doc. It was never like a day when he woke up and just, you know, sat under the tree and had a mint julep. There was a crisis. It was constant crisis.
Even hanging a clock.
It was always stuff, you know, urgencies all the time.
Is it, as a performer, is it kind of... I remember talking to Eric Idle once when he was on the podcast about Python, and he was like, that was, you know, we only did that for a couple of years, you know, but people still want to, you know.
Python?
Monty Python. Like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. So for you, is it like, well, yeah, I worked on this thing for a handful of months, but now, you know, people always want to talk about that thing, or, you know, you obviously don't foresee that when you're doing it. You think, oh, this is a job, I would imagine. But is that sort of a dream to have, or is it sometimes it's like, you know, I'm going to...
A dream to have what?
That forever people are going to be like, Back to the Future, Doc Brown, Back to the Future.
Well, I kind of think Back to the Future is sort of exceptional because it's appealed to so many generations. You know, kids that saw it when it came out initially have grown up and had children who are seeing it again. And it's like it just keeps on going, you know. And everybody that I run into, they'll one of the first things they'll say is, we have watched that film 300 times or something like that. It's just really grabbed people's imaginations, and so people are coming up all the time, you know, generations of them, you know.
You've managed to work on several movies that all hold up. Like a lot of movies that from when we're younger, you watch them again and you're like, oh, it didn't really hold up. But Back to the Future holds up. Roger Rabbit way holds up. The sequel to Adam's Family was hilarious. Adam's Family Values, I think, is one of the best comedies of all time.
That's great.
But all these movies hold up. Do you consider it like, wow, I guess it was lucky that I worked with all these great people? Like, do you have any hand? You must have a hand in that somehow. I mean, these movies are...
I don't know. I feel very fortunate to be asked to be in them and give it the best I can give it, you know. But I've always been aware that certain films I've done are kind of classics. Certainly Roger Rabbit. I mean, reviving all those cartoon characters and the whole premise of it. Adam's Family, you know, and Star Trek. I mean, they were like big films in a way, not just budgets or whatever, but conceptually, and certainly Back to the Future. But I was aware of that. I mean, I'm still looking for another one.
Were you enjoying it at the time?
Yes. I mean, it was work, and I just love doing all those characters. Are so fabulous, if you don't mind my saying so.
No, they are.
I mean, Judge Doom, fuck.
I mean, quote of the week on AV Club.
The ultimate bad guy. You know, there's not a decent. I mean, he's just so evil. Kids come up to me now, or grown-ups, and when I take the shoe and I put it into the
yes.
They tell how when they were kids, it horrified them. They yes. cried, went crazy when
and the turn too is horrifying to this day. They're like when you finally reveal that you're in tune.
Yeah,
it's just the voice and the eyes. It's just.
I mean, well, it was just such fun.
That was probably.
It was a lot of work, but I mean. It was it's like a dream to be able to get roles like that in a film that's going to go out and not, you know, disappear. It's, I've had my share of them. I'm very grateful.
I mean, you were essentially acting to almost nothing the entire time, right? I mean, everything else was...
Bob Hoskins, he had to act to nothing almost all the time.
Yeah.
More than any of us, with that rabbit, that friggin' rabbit, and he was like going nuts. He was waking up at night, fighting with a rabbit. he was going berserk, you know. He was a poor guy, but yeah, that was cool.
But you didn't. I mean, to go from a movie like that into The Addams Family, which again was another, like a real ensemble.
Mm-hmm. It was great. Yeah, that was a great. After we'd been shooting for a while, we were like a family. The oddest family in the world, but we were not dysfunctional in our own terms. You know what I mean?
You're creepy, kooky.
Yeah, we were a family.
How did you, I mean, obviously, you know, you had the TV series to kind of go off a little bit, but you guys gave those characters a little more soul than they had, you know, in the TV show, which was essentially just a, you know, a sitcom, still a fun sitcom.
Yeah.
But, you know, what was it that sort of, what did you see in Fester where you're like, oh, I think I see the piece of that guy.
I grew up on Fester. My family subscribed to the New Yorker magazine and it had, you know, this, it's got a lot of cartoons in it.
Yeah.
And Charles Addams was a contributor. So that every issue of the New Yorker magazine had a Charles Addams cartoon. Not always dealing with a family, the Addams family, but Fester pretty regularly came up.
Oh,
and as a kid growing up, every week it would come to the house. I'd be, you know, see if it was Uncle Fester. And... there's just something that really appealed to him. His kind of mischievousness, slightly evil. He wasn't a terrible bad guy, but he fucked with people a little bit or do stuff that was not. He was, you know, like the fence that has like spearheads that go down, and he'd be on a ladder filing them. and doing. Gleefully and kind of doing stuff like that. So like decades later, I get a call to do Uncle Fester. And I thought, this is unbelievable. But at the same time, I thought, how? Because he's a sight gag. He's round, kind of stubby with a round, bald head. And we worked that all out. But at first I thought, how does this work? I don't look like him at all, but we pull it off.
Do you like to do you riff and improvise on the set, or do you like to kind of know exactly what you're doing before you go on?
There's a little trial and error. I know with Fester, I was very concerned about how he sounded because you never hear him in the cartoon. in a comic strip, you don't know what he sounds. So I was very concerned about that, about finding a voice, a manner of speaking that seemed to fit. But and getting used to moving around.
A lot of the characters, do they start with voice for you? Because when I think of Reverend Jim, and I think of Fester, and I think of Doc, and I think of the Klingon general, like all of them, a lot of the power of the character really comes from the different subtle ways that you affect your voice.
I don't really. I think about the voice, but I think about the most is what does this guy look like, and that's. But that to me is the first thing I usually think of. What does he look like? What is he wearing? And how does that? Like I've gone for costume fittings, and I'm still kind of uncertain what I'm after. And they'll have selections to try on, and it'll suddenly lock into place. I put something on or whatever, and it just gives a feeling that I'm. That's it. But I don't think of voice. I think of a voice and what kind of, but it's not the first thing I think of.
That sounds like theater background. Just the costuming department and like, oh, we have to visually build the character first, and then the character can come out of.
Right.
The character just lives based on, you know, what you're seeing in the mirror. Did you have a good? Did you have a good barometer for, or did you even care about whether a movie was going to be huge or not? Like, was there one where you go, oh, this movie's going to be huge, and then it didn't pan out as big as the other ones? Or do you not think about that stuff?
I've never been that secure. I didn't. Things seem to be rolling along pretty well with Back to the Future 1, you know, they just kind of sense that. People are beginning to go crazy because they think they have a. But I don't know. I don't think too much about that. But I mean, I've done a lot of independent films that I don't think are ever going to be heard of again once we wrapped them. But there are two or three that I feel might have a shot at having a real run. You know, They're not there yet. They're still in post-production. But I could kind of try to gauge it.
Yeah.
You know, or guess it. I remember Back to the Future before Back to the Future 1, what's his name? Huey Lewis?
Yeah, Huey Lewis.
And we had a night when we all went up somewhere in California, up around San Francisco somewhere, in a studio to tape or whatever, a soundtrack or whatever, you know. And it was like an all-night thing, playing his band, playing the music. And I remember he kind of sidled over to, you know, some of the cast, Michael and myself, and saying that. And he kind of just sort of sauntered over and he says, and he just wanted to get an indication. And he said, is this going to do anything? And it was so wonderful. It was very honest. You know, what am I working on here? And he certainly fared well, wrote great music.
Oh, he did? Yeah. He did all right.
Oh, yeah. And he's a nice guy, too.
That was sort of my generation's first taste at, I guess it was around the time Ghostbusters was 84, that was 85, but the idea of a franchise really being a franchise across all platforms, it was like a huge movie and then the soundtrack was enormous and then like, and they would make music videos with scenes from the movie and then play the songs and like it really was I mean, those things where it's just like fucking like money machines at that point.
Well, Ghostbusters is what prompted Huey Lewis to do the Back to the Future soundtrack.
Oh, because Ray Parker Jr. essentially they used the riff
For I Want a New Drug.
For I Want a New Drug, yeah, for that movie.
Yeah, so it's like they asked Huey Lewis to do a song for Ghostbusters. He said no. Then they just ripped off one of his songs and made really? A bunch of money. So he's like, well, then next time someone asks,
fuck it, I'm just going to do it myself. Yeah, yeah. Did you kind of learn to be more secure as a performer through the years, or do you still feel like the same guy going, fuck?
No, I feel more secure, and I love working. I mean, I work quite a bit, again, in films that may never see the light of day, and I just feel myself getting, you know, more experienced and better at it. So, it feels good. You know, there's always the first take on your first day is always like kind of like, you know, I don't sleep well the night before. I've prepared whatever I've prepared, makeup, costume, the whole thing. But I don't know. Is it going to work? Is the director going to say, Chris, you know, let's talk, Ben. Everybody, you can go ahead. I don't know, you know, and you really don't know until you make that initial step, you know, whether it's what they're looking for or not.
What's your favorite kind of movie to do?
I don't know. I don't know that I have. I don't really think too much about the character I'm going to do, prefer to do, or the kind of movie it's going to be. I hope it's... The people are great who are handling it, and it's funded well enough, and the script is good, and that I have something nice to work with.
I really wanted to see. Did you see the Funny or Die Gobstopper video where you did the Willy Wonka?
Eric Appel.
Oh, that was Eric Appel. Yeah, because Paul Scheer and a bunch of our friends were in that. I wanted to see that whole fucking movie. Like that,
I would love it. I mean, I loved doing that guy. I loved it.
It was great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm doing another one tomorrow.
What are you doing? No, we'll turn these off. What are you doing? Which one are you doing tomorrow?
I'm doing one tomorrow where the hoverboard has been invented. And I'm a pitchman for it.
Oh, great.
And I've got celebrities lined up who are demonstrating it. I'm saying, I'm to be in a suit and tie. And I announce myself, I'm Christopher Lloyd. Back in the day, hoverboards were unimaginable. Here we are.
Just in time for 2015.
So that's it'll be fun.
Do you know there's a whole kind of online meme about how there's like websites with the countdown clock to 2015, and then we're fucking almost. And yesterday was November 12th. Yesterday was the day the clock tower got struck by lightning. Yesterday was November 12th. So we like there was a big thing online about that being the Hill Valley Clock Tower Day. And then in less than 2 years, it will be the day where you guys go back in part two.
Wow.
So I don't know. Virtually nothing that was predicted in the movie actually ended up happening. People tried to make the self-lacing shoes. That didn't really work out.
They made the hat.
You got the hat's about the only thing. Yeah, the hat's about the only thing.
I think that's about it. Cubs still haven't won.
No, they haven't. No, they still haven't won. I mean, do you write? Do you want to write stuff too? No, you just want to act.
Yeah. I'm directing... That's a whole different sphere.
Directing looks shitty to me. Like, that doesn't look fun.
Yeah.
It does not look fun. I watch...
And you kind of have to be an asshole to do it.
Well, maybe, I don't know if it's you have to be an asshole, but I think what it is that you have to be confident in making decisions every second of the day.
Yeah.
Because you are... And not only are you making decisions, but you're also having to... You are the focal point between the performers, the crew, the studio, the producers. Like, everyone... And it's all riding on your shoulders. And you have to keep all this in balance and manage to keep your vision the way that you want.
Uh-huh.
Like, the whole thing, just it just sounds not fun at all. Like, it doesn't sound like... And then there I was, and Spielberg just was running the camera, and I was behind him in the sun. Like, you, I think those moments are so quick, but the rest of it is just all political shit that you have to deal with.
You got weeks of pre-production,
yeah,
and then weeks of post-production. I mean, not my life.
No, it's a very specific. Yeah, I think it's a very specific muscle that people. I mean, I respect people who can do it. Just to me, it just the process moves so slow, and that it just doesn't.
I remember Zemeckis, because he had so many questions all day and about decisions to make. Like you said, one day he said something like he felt like he'd be pecked to death by a herd of ducks or something. Something to that effect. You know, like, tell me this. Why did this? Where did this? When do I do this? Who should do that?
Did Spielberg spend a lot of time on the set? Did he? No. Just to tell you Eric Stoltz was fired.
Here to soften the blow, Steven Spielberg.
Hey guys, I didn't eat tea. Eric Stoltz is out.
Oh, yeah. So delightful, that chat.
He brought E.T. with him.
Yeah.
This little E.T. coming out.
Go home.
He'd be there once in a while.
Jonah just said that Spielberg would have E.T. go up to Eric Stoltz and go home.
Thanks.
That's why I love this guy. That's how Spielberg should fire everyone.
Yeah.
How could you be bummed if you're like, I got fired, but the creature touched me with his finger?
Yeah, but I got a family.
Ouch. Is it, you know? I know you've done both, but do you prefer locking into like a really strong character, or what about you just playing a guy, just a regular guy who is a regular guy?
I don't get too much of that. I do a little bit, like because I've reached a certain age, I'm getting a fair amount of grandpa type guys who are just grandpas.
Right.
They're not grandpa from outer space, or just grandpas, which is nice. I like doing that. Then again, I don't want them all to be the same, so I try to figure out ways to make each grandpa different. And then I had a film I finished about 2 months ago where I'm just very much myself, but I'm deadly. I'm like an aging leader of a mob. And in love with a very young girl, but I'm lethal. I'm fucking lethal, and I haven't had that, you know, like not like Captain Krug, you know, Star Trek. Yeah. Makeup, just the guy, you know, who's beginning to lose it. Yeah. His control of what is happening around him, and I loved it. I don't know if it'll go anywhere, but it was just nice feeling, you know.
I really feel like you're an actor who a really good, like an HBO show or like an AMC show, something. Someone would go, "Oh, you like what you just described,"
mm-hmm.
and that people would see a whole different side of you like that.
Yeah.
You're like, holy shit. And then really remember, like, oh yeah, that's because he's a fucking great actor. That's why he doesn't, like, you could play that guy and play like a really seriously dramatic.
Yeah. I tended to get more parts like that in the theater, actually.
All right.
I saw just the other day the movie with, I can't remember the title, Shaughnessy.
What was it about?
It's about a guy who's discovered he has AIDS, and he's a real, real addict. And the actor lost an incredible amount of weight to play the role.
Is it in theaters now?
Yeah.
Dallas Buyers Club? Dallas Buyers Club.
What's the name of the actor?
Matthew McConaughey.
Dallas Buyers Club.
Yeah.
Good,
yeah.
Katie. Well done.
Yeah.
Katie,
she knows her AIDS movies.
Okay, good. Nice. Jonah,
go home.
That's great. But he, have you seen it?
Yeah.
He's amazing. I just thought, all the time, I thought it's like an acting lesson. He's doing the hardest kind of stuff, material to do. And he just has moments in it that are incredible. And he's, and I just didn't see one false moment all the way through it.
Wow. McConaughey.
Wow. He just, it's Brando-ish in its depth, and unless I was just not seeing straight, but I just
the reviews have been really good. The recent movie has been really good.
Yeah. And also, I heard he was great in Mud. I heard he was really good in that movie.
Yeah,
I haven't seen that, but just really incredible role, and the whole movie is good, and the other people in it. But he just a really, really tough.
Do you watch more movies, or are you a fan of TV at all? Do you watch any TV stuff?
Not too much. I want to watch news and sports. I surf.
Oh, you do?
Surfing.
Oh, I thought you meant you surf. I'm sorry, I took that literally. I was like, holy shit. Well, you're a tall guy. You look like you're in good shape. I could totally buy you as a surfer. If anyone is listening and you're casting any hard-hitting dramas on HBO or AMC, Christopher Lloyd is your guy. So we do get people do listen to the show.
Uh-huh.
Like it's not crazy that
something could.
I'm not saying it's .
No, I'm available too.
Jonah, no one cares.
No, sorry, I just had to jump in. That was a free for all.
But there's so much good, since you like independent films, so much of the independent film spirit is alive on television right now.
Yeah.
So it seems like there's something, there's stuff out there. And maybe it's, I even wonder if in cases with actors like yourself, if people just go, oh, he'd never want to do this, so they just don't ask.
I don't know. Word may have gotten around that I won't do anything. I'm going to do an episode on Michael J. Fox.
Oh, you are?
Oh, no way.
Yeah. I'm really excited about that.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well,
funny thing, Eric Appel, who directed the Gobstopper thing.
Huh?
Eric Appel, who directed Gobstopper.
Yeah.
He directed a few episodes of the Michael J. Fox show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder if he's directing that one.
I don't know. It's possible. He just wrapped up another show.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Well, you guys have done, you guys have popped up together in a few things just around anniversaries of the movie. And,
yeah.
Of the, and like DVD releases and stuff like that. And that's fun. Do you have any idea? Do you know what you're doing on the show yet, or do you just agree to do it, to appear on it?
Yeah, he's the new principal of their school where his kids go, who's anti-education sort of, or he just has a different way of going about it, which is causing problems.
Nice.
Doesn't have the right attitude. Nice attitude, fun, but kids aren't learning anything.
Oh, so sort of, as we're kind of winding down, kind of looking back, do you sort of feel like, is there anything that you wish you knew then, or what did you learn, or what did you, when you kind of look back at all of it, and, not that it's, there's still a lot more to do, but what do you think you've taken away from everything so far? Like, how do you feel when you think back about all the stuff you've done?
I feel good. I've really gotten to do some wonderful parts and wonderful projects, and far more than I imagined when I started out. I just didn't see it. I wanted it, but I had no confidence that it was ever going to happen, because everybody does. Everybody starts out, oh boy, I hope I can do this and that. And then bit by bit, sort of came together. And I got to do roles and express myself through them in a way that really meant a lot to me. You know, because that's what you're doing it for. You know, you're trying to share your take on things. And I got roles where I've had multiple opportunities to do that. So that's fabulous. I still do. You know, and so I'm very happy about that.
Is there one character that you feel like, oh, just one more time, I just want to do this guy one more time?
Let me see. I don't know. I did for the stage, I did Death of a Salesman about 3 years ago, and I'd like to do it again. I really would. Because that's such an incredible, wonderful role. But the movies, it seems to me that when you do it, it's your best shot. You know, I mean, you do a play, and it might be a classic or not, and you grow into it as you do it. Somehow the movie is like, when you do it, each scene or each take is the best it's going to be. You know, it's not like you get to play it again.
But if like they were to do another movie and something, I mean, do you feel like there's still something and you're like, oh, I'd love to play that guy again? Or do you feel like once you're done, you did it?
No, I'd love to do another Star Trek. They were about 3 or 4 years, after Roger Rabbit, there was constant talk about they were going to do a sequel and that they were somehow magically coming back, you know, because I perished at the end of the first.
Yeah.
And I would have loved to do Doom again.
I think, unfortunately, that's just a licensing issue. I can't imagine that. Imagine that all the lawyers and all those companies would ever allow that to happen again.
That's what I was kind of hearing, that, you know, some licensing or getting all those cartoon characters. I don't know. But that doesn't seem to be happening. There's a lot of speculation about maybe a movie of Taxi, you know. Not now that I know of, but that would have been fun.
Have you guys done a cast reunion anytime in the last... anytime recently?
Well, we get together for... Well, I did a play in New York a few months ago, and Danny and Tony and Mary Lou and a woman whose name... Carol Kane. Mm-hmm. All came to it, and that was cool. We had a nice reunion. And then recently, so it kind of happens when, like, I don't know if you've seen the Judd Hirsch and Danny doing the...
Oh, I saw Sunshine Boys. The posters were all over town. I haven't seen the play yet, though.
Yeah. We went to see it, me and my friend, opening night, and it's wonderful. I mean, they're loving doing it, and they're just—it's fun to go see.
Someone, a friend of mine, produced a comedy festival, and they had, and Danny DeVito came and spoke at the comedy festival, I think, with James Brooks, and they said that he was fucking hysterical. That Danny DeVito not only has amazing stories, but he has no filters. Like, he'll just say, like, he just tells stories about people, and he doesn't give a shit. He just doesn't give a shit. But they're not mean, but just funny. Like, he's just super, super funny.
He has a great sense of humor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What were you guys, and I'm sorry if you hate this question or if you're sick of answering it, but what was happening the whole time that Andy Kaufman was doing all the Andy Kaufman stuff, and it was spinning, you know, outside the show, and he was, like, pranking the show and pranking the public, and did that feel like it was getting in the way, or were you cool with it?
I mean, a lot of that, I think, happened before I came on the show.
Right.
A lot of things. But I just sort of, that's what it is. I mean, he seemed like a really nice guy. I mean, people ask me, he's crazy. And I don't think he was crazy at all. He just had his own agenda, the kind of comedy he wanted to create that he believed in, and he stuck to it. But he he was serious. I mean, he worked. He'd come in and work. Sometimes he'd be out in his car meditating when he needed to be in, you know, doing womb drills or something.
Yeah.
But he was very present. Yeah.
Yeah, he definitely clearly wasn't crazy. I mean, you can't. Yeah. Everything was so calculated.
Exactly.
Crazy people yeah. don't have that precise yeah. amount of calculation.
No, he's. The thing that I'll never forget, there was a discussion about while we were rehearsing one day, the camera crews and all that on the taxi set, and there was some kind of discussion that came up about levitating. And and Andy said, yeah, I could do that. Because he was into a lot of spiritual stuff. And we had a break. And he sat down on this on the stage floor of Taxi, got into a yogi, and just composed himself. And we all stood around waiting for him to levitate. Because he had the balls to sit down there and get ready to do it, to get himself into a levitation zone. And we all waited for him to levitate. and we maybe thought, well, he's never going to be able to do that, but what the fuck is sitting down there doing it? And we're all watching him. Something's got to happen. And eventually the production manager, whatever, said, we got to go back to work. But I'll never forget. I mean, that was Andy, you know. He wasn't being, he just, that was, it was pretty cool.
That's no one committed to things.
Yeah.
Like when that guy committed to something, there was no,
yeah.
there was no breaking it.
It was just, what a scene, you know.
Well, this has been an absolute pleasure, and I hope you had a nice time.
I did.
I know we made you talk about a lot of stuff you've talked about a million times, but, you know, we're huge fans, and, you know, we tried not to get too fanboy on you, but we are just thrilled that you're here.
I had a delightful time, and what a surprise.
I should tell people that you are the voice of the hacker on Cyber Chase, which
uh-huh.
is a children's cartoon on PBS. Which is like it's like a math cartoon. It's like a cartoon about kind of like this cyber adventure team using math,
yeah.
and you are the villain.
And problems come up in each episode that are like in the storyline, but can only be solved mathematically. And so the good characters in it have to think, how do we solve this problem? And it's something having to do with arithmetic or mathematics. So the kids watch it, get to see how mathematics could be applied to solve everyday problems.
And that's on, is that on right now? Cyber Chase on right now?
No, they're sort of a bit of an extended hiatus for whatever reason, but it's going to start up again pretty soon.
Great.
Yeah.
All right, so Cyber Chase, and then anyone, any HBO or AMC or IFC executives who
I'm
say,
I'm completely
hey.
Available.
No, Jonah, it's not going to be you. It's not going to be you.
I can be Bruce too.
I want Christopher Lloyd on an Emmy-winning drama playing a fucked-up character. If I could somehow have a hand in that, I will feel like I could check that off a bucket list of some type. And listen, in the Emmy acceptance speech, if you want to say, Chris said, you know, I don't mean to get ahead of myself here, but when you do win that Emmy for that job that's going to come, you know, just a nod or just like a scratch your ear and I'll know that it's me.
I don't know. I've had been this agent I've got for a long time. Maybe.
He gives good lunch.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you.
All right, excellent. Thanks, man. Good to see you.
Yeah.
And enjoy your burrito, everyone. Spectacular.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Nancy's love story could have been ripped right out of the pages of one of her own novels.
She was a romance mystery writer who happens to be married to a chef.
But this story didn't end with a happily ever after.
When I stepped into the kitchen, I could see that Chef Brophy was on the ground, and I heard somebody say, call 911.
As writers, we'd written our share of murder mysteries. So when suspicion turned to Dan's wife, Nancy, we weren't that surprised.
The first person they look at would be the spouse.
We understand that's usually the way they do it.
But we began to wonder, had Nancy gotten so wrapped up in her own novels?
There are murders in all of the books.
That she was playing them out in real life? You can listen to Happily Never After, Dan and Nancy, early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.